Hello, and welcome to the Fall 2010 podcast for the journal Pediatric Physical Therapy. I'm Donovan Stutel. This month, standardized measures and assessments. For children with neuromuscular disorders, more definitive assessments of trunk control. For children with ABI, a measure more challenging than the GMFM. The PD for children receiving early intervention services. The AIMS for infants born preterm, and more. This podcast is brought to you by the Section on Pediatrics of the American Physical Therapy Association. The section seeks to promote the highest quality of life for all children, people with developmental disabilities, and their families. First this month, editor Anne Van Sant with her editorial discussing a colleague's plea.
A number of years ago, I had the good fortune to be able to travel around the United States as part of a small group of physical therapists gathering information on the body of knowledge that underpins our profession. After several meetings of a large group of faculty members who were highly regarded for their knowledge of foundational and clinical sciences of physical therapy, a smaller group of individuals traveled to a series of small regional meetings. At these meetings, practicing clinicians provided insight into their areas of practice and the foundational knowledge that they used frequently as they examined, assessed, and established goals and intervention plans for their clients. Such opportunities to gain regional perspectives are of untold value in helping to shape our own perceptions of the profession, and they often guide our views for years to come. Of the many diverse viewpoints expressed during those regional meetings, one repeatedly comes to mind. It was a colleague's frustration over a very basic bit of foundational knowledge that she found to be decidedly absent in many new physical therapist graduates. That is, the knowledge and skill to obtain precise and reliable measures of patients' impairments and functional skills. I can still recall her impassioned plea for academic and clinical faculty to take seriously the need for our next generation of therapists to be trained to obtain reliable measures during their examinations and re-examinations. One source of the problem that she lamented arose from a lack of precision in carrying out well-defined measurement techniques, such as careful use of measurement tools and proper positioning of our patients when taking standard measures, even those as common and fundamental as range of motion. I remember her concern that good decisions could not be made on the basis of sloppy measurement. Her plea had as much to do with ensuring that therapists valued reliability and precision in measurement as it did with gaining skill and obtaining the measures. Another source of the problem was the failure of therapists to use standardized tests when they were available to them. Of course, at the time, we did not have a wide array of tests and measures available to us that address specific concerns of pediatric physical therapists. But since that time, we have witnessed an era of development of reliable and valid measures specific to our practice. Therapists now have the advantage of being able to select among tests and measures those most appropriate to the pediatric patient populations they serve. In this issue, the development and utility of a variety of tests and measures designed for use by pediatric physical therapists is a major theme. From the introduction of the SATCO for the measurement of trunk control and the development of a test for children with acquired brain injury who are high functioning, to the reports of expanded uses for the pediatric evaluation of disability inventory and the Alberta Infant Motor Scale, we are reminded of the rich array of measures that have been carefully developed to document our patients' abilities. Yet my colleague's plea still resonates with me. In this issue, Swigum and colleagues report that therapists do not use standardized pain measures that are readily available. Gray, Ng, and Bartlett note that little is written about the clinical use of the gross motor function classification system. The plea for therapists to value and use precise, reliable measures in their practice seems to be as relevant today as it was back in the 1980s. It will not be long before we will be able to enter our measures into national or international electronic databases that will allow study of the effectiveness of our interventions for specific groups of patients, and my colleague's plea will move front and center. At that point, we will have to face the problem of valuing standardized classification schemes and measures and their precise and reliable administration. And I envision the cultural change in our practice that will result, and that should make my colleagues smile.
Refinement, reliability, and validity of the Segmental Assessment of Trunk Control by Penelope Butler of Robert Jones and Agnes Hunt Hospital in Oswestry, Shropshire, United Kingdom, and Sandy Saavedra, Madeline Sofranock, Sarah Jarvis, and Marjorie Woollacott. The Segmental Assessment of Trunk Control, SATCO, provides a systematic method of assessing discrete levels of trunk control in children with motor disabilities. This study refined the assessment method and examined reliability and validity of the SATCO. After refining guidelines, 102 video recordings of the SATCO were made of 8 infants with typical development, followed longitudinally from 3 to 9 months of age, and 24 children with neuromotor disability with a mean age of 10 years, 4 months. 8 researchers independently scored recordings. Intraclass correlation coefficient values for inter-rater reliability were more than 0.84 across all datasets. Intra-rater reliability was 0.98 across all datasets and all aspects of control. Tests of concurrent validity with the Alberta Infant Motor Scales resulted in coefficients ranging from 0.86 to 0.88. The authors conclude that the SATCO is a reliable and valid measure, allowing clinicians greater specificity in assessing trunk control. That was Refinement, Reliability, and Validity of the Segmental Assessment of Trunk Control by Butler et al. This article is the subject of our first clinical bottom line. This clinical bottom line is written by Karen Cott of Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, and Sharon Held of both Damon College in Amherst, New York, and Sport Focus Physical Therapy in Orchard Park, New York. Joining us now is Karen Cott. Welcome, Karen.
Good morning.
First, tell us, how could a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article?
Well, this article is called Segmental Assessment of Trunk Control. So the way that therapists would apply it would be looking at how this article gives full information about using the system to assess trunk control, but of all segments of the trunk. So it's not just looking at full trunk control, but it's actually looking at the individual pieces of the trunk, including the head, the thorax, and then the end of the spinal column, which is the lumbar area, looking at that control, and then also looking at the full trunk control. It is a more clear, concise way of examining the body to look for possible impairments in any of those levels. And there has really not been a test that has been able to do that to this point. So this is adding to our body of knowledge about being able to make more specific recommendations about what is it that I'm going to treat once I decide that this child has a problem with their trunk control. So the other thing that is good about this is it also looks at the control in 3 different ways. It looks at how it defines static, active, and reactive sitting balance. The static balance, everybody would understand, is being just steady balance without support. The active, or another word they use for that, is anticipatory, and that would be balance while reaching. And the last one, reactive, is looking at how a child maintains or regains balance after they've had a perturbation. So it's really looking at all aspects of sitting balance. The tool being able to be applied to any children with a range of abilities. So there's no age limit to this tool. It really is related to looking at sitting control in any child of any age with a neurodevelopmental problem. The other information that's provided from the article is that it talks to the clinician about compensatory strategies that may be used. The type of strategies they're talking about would be things like additionally using their hands for support, or leaning their trunk forward or backwards, or actually even collapsing vertically so the child shows excessive kyphosis or actually even shows an increased lordosis in their trunk. one of the things that was also interesting about them talking about these strategies is that the strategies were not unique to whether the child was typically developing or had a neuromotor disability. These strategies depended more upon how much control the child actually had above or below where they were being supported. The thing that is important to remember about this clinically is that if you follow the instructions closely, you should have excellent reliability when you're using this tool for testing.
And when a pediatric PT is considering performing this test on a patient in their clinic, what should they be mindful about?
The things they should remember about this test is that, first of all, in order to be as reliable as possible, the authors noted that the raters had been trained, but as a clinician, if you're diligent about following the instructions, you should be able to do it without excessive training or practice. The other thing that's important about this is for some parts of the test, you actually need two people for testing. When you're doing the reactive sitting, one person is providing the support and the other person is providing the nudges during the testing. A third thing to think about is that there is simple equipment needed to control the pelvis while testing. Even though that information is provided in the article, it doesn't necessarily have to be the specific way. You could come up with another way, but the pelvis does need to be controlled. Also, the authors recommend that you videotape what you're doing. That may help with the reliability. The last thing to think about is that if you're going to use this tool for assessment of body function, it's only one component of your assessment and that you need to complement it with other measures of activity and participation. This test is going to need further assessment to determine if it's going to be sensitive enough to look for change over time.
Karen, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Next, severity and characteristics of developmental delay can be assessed using variability measures of sitting posture. By Anastasia Cavellido of the University of Nebraska at Omaha in Omaha, Nebraska, and Regina Harborn and Nicholas Sturgio. The authors sought to identify measures of variability from sitting postural sway that are significantly different among infants who were developing typically, those who were developmentally delayed or hypotonic, and those who later on had a diagnosis of spastic or athetoid cerebral palsy. 65 infants were evaluated when they were just developing the ability to sit upright. The infants were evaluated by assessing center of pressure data, using measures of both amount and temporal organization of center of pressure variability. The results indicated that measures of variability of center of pressure could discriminate between infants with developmental delay and infants with cerebral palsy. Furthermore, these measures could add to the description of sitting postural behavior. The authors conclude that their method of evaluating sitting postural control could be an objective tool to help describe distinctive features of motor delay in an individual infant and could lead in the design of selective therapeutic interventions for improving postural control of infants with motor delays. That was Severity and Characteristics of Developmental Delay Can Be Assessed Using Variability Measures of Sitting Posture by Cavellido, Harborn, and Sturgio. This article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line, this written by Jan-Jaap van der Net and Mike A. Sprong, both of University Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Utrecht, the Netherlands. In addressing the question, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article, the authors respond, this study describes a method of measuring postural control in infants with motor delays and motor impairments of known and unknown origins. The motor ability tested in this study was the ability to sit for a few seconds, with or without use of the arms, without engaging in any other activity. Potentially, the method of measurement provides insight on the amount of variance in postural control in infants under controlled circumstances. In terms of the International Classification of Function, Disability, and Health, this study focuses primarily on the component of body function, that is, postural control, which is necessary for maintaining the sitting position. It does not measure the activity of sitting, Currently, pediatric physical therapists are encouraged to focus on the activity participation level of children in activities such as sitting while playing. This focus on body function is an important limitation of this study that does make it hard to apply the results in clinical practice. Infants with developmental delay and infants with cerebral palsy show less variability in postural control while sitting. Motor variability has been regarded by many as a key sign of normal motor development. Therefore, it has become an important diagnostic entity in pediatric physical therapy to recognize children with potential motor impairment. At the same time, inducing motor variability has become an important aim in pediatric physical therapy treatment. Addressing the question of what pediatric physical therapists should be mindful about when applying this information, the authors write, "It remains to be seen if a child in a more ecological environment, for instance, during a play session, will show the same postural variability as in the test situation. This method of measuring variance in postural control does not provide the observer information on the adaptability of the child to his or her environment, for instance, while manipulating a toy. This is a significant limitation of this study." Another concern is the large difference in age between the groups. Motor development of the different groups of children may be similar, but based on the difference in calendar age, one might expect that there is a difference in cognitive development between the different groups of children. It is unclear whether cognitive development influences adaptive motor strategies in sitting. Next, development of a challenge assessment tool for high-functioning children with an acquired brain injury by Robin Ibe of the University of Toronto in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and seven others. The purpose of this study was to develop a performance-based challenge assessment to evaluate gross motor abilities of high-functioning youth with an acquired brain injury. Potential items were identified from the literature. A panel of four expert physical therapists selected items on the basis of three criteria: safety to test, feasibility to administer, and importance to perform. Item reduction was completed using ratings from a physical therapist web survey. The Acquired Brain Injury Challenge Assessment, ABICA, was created and pilot tested with youth with an acquired brain injury. 78 items were identified and reduced to 47 items following expert panel discussion. Web survey item reduction by 75 pediatric physical therapists yielded a 24-item ABICA that was administered to six youth aged 8 to 17 years with an acquired brain injury. The ABICA mean score out of a total of 81 points was 51 plus or minus 17 points. The authors conclude that the acquired brain injury challenge assessment was feasible to administer and demonstrated gross motor activity challenges beyond the gross motor function measure. Prior to clinical or research use, it will be required to refine the response options and validate the assessment. That was Development of a Challenge Assessment Tool for High-Functioning Children with an Acquired Brain Injury by Ibe et al. This article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line, this written by Jennifer Braswell Christie of the University of Alabama and Penny Turner of Children's Health System, both in Birmingham, Alabama. Joining us now is Jennifer Braswell Christie. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
First, tell us, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article?
Well, the challenge assessment tool for high-functioning children with acquired brain injury was developed out of a need for a tool to measure high-level skills for children and adolescents with acquired brain injury. And I'm sure we've all treated a child with ABI or other conditions who is walking and maybe even running okay, and they scored normally on tests like the GMFM or the Brunix or the BOT2, but the child is still unable to return to the soccer team or skate with his friends or ride a two-wheeled bike like he did before the accident. So therefore, the child obviously needs physical therapy, but there also needs to be an outcome tool to objectively measure progress. current tools are unable to appropriately measure high-level gross motor skills since they might not include real-life items or items that combine agility and speed. They might also have a ceiling effect in this population. So some of the examples that the authors gave were the BOT 2, or the second edition of the Brunix. Gross motor skill doesn't really have any real-life activities. The community balance and mobility scale evaluates only balance. High-level mobility assessment tool lacks activities that combine speed and agility, such as reversing directions, and doesn't really take into account quality of movement. And then the GMFM doesn't really have any high-level tasks, so children with acquired brain injury might have a ceiling effect. But this tool measures change in performance of advanced gross motor skills that represent balance and postural control, coordination, agility and speed, and strength. And scoring was modeled after the GMFM walk-run jump dimension, and it is scored on an ordinal scale, just like the GMFM, from 0 being initiates or partially completes to 3 being optimal performance, and each item is criterion referenced. So this manuscript describes the very first stage in the development of this tool, the content validity and clinical feasibility, to include pilot testing on 6 high-functioning children and adolescents with ABI. It was developed in the following stages. So based on review of the literature and existing outcome tools, an expert panel of 4 chose 78 items to represent a gross motor category. And these items were judged by 75 experts who scored them on safety, feasibility, and importance. So 28 items met the criteria that the authors set, and they were chosen for pilot testing on 6 children who were high functioning and scored at least a 90% on the walk, run, jump dimension of the GMFM. So if you look at Table 2 of the article, it provides the participants' scores for each of the items and also tells you what the items are. And 4 of the items were tested bilaterally. They ended up eliminating 1 item during the pilot testing, and so the final number of items were 23. Table 2 shows the items that measure balance, and one of the items were standing on toes on a compliant surface or the bird dog exercise, where I assume that the child gets in quadruped and lifts either the right or the left arm. Coordination, one of the items were running in and out of cones. Speed and agility, it was a test with running and shuffling side to side. And then one of the strength items were a standing long jump. So these are very high-level skills that need to be tested in this population. Instructions and scoring for each item were adjusted during the pilot testing based on their observation and feedback from the subjects. And it took an hour to complete, and the children were not fatigued, and there didn't appear to be a ceiling or a floor effect. So it's a good test.
And what should a pediatric PT be mindful about when applying this information?
Well, clinicians should be mindful that the challenge assessment is in the early development stage, so it's not really yet ready for clinical use. But evidence-based clinicians should be excited and eagerly awaiting validation and also reliability and validity testing. So the final outcome tool will be instrumental in justifying treatment for children with ABI who want to return to sports and other high-level activities. And also, clinicians should be mindful that to do these items, children need to be functioning at a high level. They cannot have any cardiorespiratory or orthopedic conditions that preclude them from running and must also have good attention span. Hopefully, in the future, a test like this can be validated for other populations, such as children with mild CP or Down syndrome, or just any population who desire to improve their high-level skills.
Jennifer, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me.
Next, clinometric properties of the Alberta Infant Motor Scale in infants born preterm by Thomas Pinn of Children's Hospital at Westmead in Sydney, Australia, and Katie DeValle, Bev Eldridge, and Mary Galia. The Alberta Infant Motor Scale, AIMS, is a standardized motor assessment for young infants. This study aimed to examine the reliability of the AIMS in a group of infants born at or before 29 weeks of gestation. 59 infants born preterm were recruited. 2 experienced pediatric physical therapists participated in this reliability study. Infants were assessed at 4, 8, 12, and 18 months corrected age. The intraclass correlation coefficient for intra-rater reliability was greater than 0.99. The intraclass correlation coefficient for inter-rater reliability varied from 0.85 to 0.97. The intraclass correlation coefficient was low at 4 and 18 months corrected age. The authors conclude that the AIMS is reliable in evaluating motor development in infants born preterm. However, clinicians should be cautious about using the AIMS in infants at very young ages and those approaching independent ambulation. Additionally, accurate placement of the window on a movement repertoire is crucial. Attention is required when using the AIMS in infants developing atypically. That was Clinometric Properties of the Alberta Infant Motor Scale in Infants Born Preterm by Pin et al. This article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line. This clinical bottom line was written by Barbara Womack of Kid Ability Mobile Pediatric Physical Therapy in Phoenix, Arizona, and Carolyn Hariza of Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Joining us now is Barbara Womack. Barbara, welcome again to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
First, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article?
Well, this article was a study that looked at 59 infants that were extremely premature, which means 29 weeks gestational age or less, and looked at them between the ages of 4 and 18 months. And this is a population that was not looked at prior using the AIMS or the Alberta Infant Motor Scale previously. So this is a new population to see if the AIMS was applicable. And as you know, the AIMS is a norm-referenced assessment of motor development for infants from birth to 18 months. And it was designed to look at motor development over time up to 18 months and to identify motor delays. So some of the messages that I took home from this particular study is that this study, in addition to other studies, have found that the AIMS is a reliable tool for evaluating motor development in infants that are term and that are early premature, and now this extreme premature population of 29 weeks gestational age or less. However, there were gaps that were found in the motor skills of infants that were born extremely premature, particularly cited in the prone and sitting sequences in the AIMS manual. And this, they believe, is due to the strong extensor strength in these infants. And it takes them in a different trajectory of motor development skills than the other categories of infants that have been studied. The difference of the movement patterns of infants that are born at term and infants that are extreme premature, such as a strongly extended posture, present a difficulty when you're trying to determine the least and the most mature skills in each subscale of the AIMS. It may affect the overall subscore and therefore the overall score of the AIMS in this population because the score is based on where that window of functioning is between the least and most mature skill subsets. So although the AIMS test does not require specific training, experienced therapists that are familiar with infant motor development and motor movement analysis are more reliable testers. It's recommended that novice therapists and non-therapists that might be using the AIMS for testing should receive some training. And the other piece of advice is that a serial assessment of infants at risk should be given over time to avoid any misdiagnosis.
And what should a pediatric PT be mindful about when applying this information?
Well, the AIMS is less reliable in infants that are very young, that is under age 4 months, and those approaching independent ambulation, which would be after 12 months. And this is believed to be due to the limited number of test items in both of these ranges. So the greatest reliability of the AIMS is in the mid-ranges between these two ages. The placement of the window of movement repertoire, that is the window of skills between the least and most mature skills, is crucial in determining the final test outcome. This window might be more difficult to determine in infants that are born extremely premature because of the quality of their movement being different than infants that are born at term. And another thing to remember is that the AIMS is not designed for use in atypically developing infants, and it should be used cautiously within this group.
Barbara, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
next. Ankle strength and functional limitations in children and adolescents with type 1 osteogenesis imperfecta by Angela Caudill of Shriners Hospitals for Children in Chicago, Illinois, and six others. The purpose of this study was to determine, 1, whether children with type 1 osteogenesis imperfecta, OI, exhibit ankle plantar flexor weakness, and 2, whether this correlates with physical function. 20 children and adolescents with type 1 OI and 20 age-matched controls between the ages of 6 and 18 years participated in a single evaluation session. Data included strength assessment, Gillette Functional Assessment Questionnaire, Pediatric Outcome Data Collection Instrument, and FACES Pain Scale Revised. Ankle plantar flexor weakness was evident in the OI group compared with the control group. Heel rise strength correlated with ankle isometric plantar flexion strength. Limitations in the Pediatric Outcome Data Collection Instrument subscales, sports and physical function, and pain/comfort are present in the OI group. The authors conclude that ankle plantar flexor weakness is present in children and adolescents with type 1 OI, and this weakness correlates with function. Gillette Functional Assessment Questionnaire, Pediatric Outcome Data Collection Instrument, and Strength Assessment are all valuable evaluation tools for children and adolescents with type 1 OI and can aid therapists in goal setting. That was Ankle Strength and Functional Limitations in Children and Adolescents with Type 1 Osteogenesis Imperfecta by Caudill et al. This article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line, written by Maureen Donahoe of the Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, and Holly Sintas of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. In addressing the question, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article? The authors reply, in a review of the data, ankle strength is associated with skills that have an important effect on activities of daily living, such as standing on one foot and walking on stairs without a handrail. In this study, riding a bicycle without training wheels is also associated with ankle plantar flexion strength. However, only 50% of the children tested found riding a bicycle easy. 35% could not perform the task at all. The task of riding a bicycle may be self-limiting because of the risk of fracture, but it is also considered more recreational than functional, so it may not be a priority for these individuals. When planning for a person who has type 1 OI, it is important to identify potential strength deficits as well as functional limitations in order to train skills while strengthening. Addressing the question, what should a pediatric PT be mindful about when applying this information? The authors reply, it is important to note that 45% of the OI group subjects had at least one fracture in the year before testing, whereas none of the control group subjects had documented fractures. Immobilization and decreased activity due to fractures cause disuse atrophy. Although there is a high correlation between ankle strength and higher functional skills, such as standing on one foot, and managing stairs without a rail, these children are at risk for fractures, so adaptations may be necessary to safely perform these skills. Although strengthening may be beneficial, especially for children who have been immobilized and have secondary weakness, strength alone will not create skill. It is a complement to gaining skill. For children with OI, strengthening may create a stronger extremity that is complicated by collagen defects impacting on joint stability and potential alignment issues due to long bone fractures. Next, Growing Older with Cerebral Palsy, Insider's Perspectives, by Marilyn Horseman of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and Melinda Suto, Brian Dudgeon, and Susan Harris. Research has shown that adults with cerebral palsy, CP, lose functional abilities earlier than persons who are able-bodied. Because CP is a lifespan disability, developmental therapists should be aware of these changes. The authors used descriptive phenomenology to understand the unique lived experiences of adults growing older with CP. Data were gathered through in-depth, semi-structured interviews. Open-ended questions asked what it was like to age with CP. how these experiences were understood, how strategies were used to cope with changes, and what are the meanings of these experiences. A theme emerged from the data analysis: awareness, acceptance, and action. Participants were aware that their bodies were deteriorating quicker than those of their peers who were able-bodied. They developed acceptance that hastened actions toward improving their quality of life. The authors conclude that these findings provide insights for pediatric therapists who work with children with CP about what may be important to their clients as they grow older. That was Growing Older with Cerebral Palsy: Insiders' Perspectives, by Horseman et al. Next, a longitudinal study of outcome measures for children receiving early intervention services, by Heidi Johnson Eagsty of Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah, and Lynette Chandler, Cordelia Robinson, and Amy Winters Botkin. The purpose of this study was to compare the Pediatric Evaluation of Disability Inventory, PEDI, and the Mullen Scales of Early Learning, EMSL, as measures of change in children who received early intervention services. 34 children were stratified into two groups according to the presence of gross motor delay. The PEDI and EMSL were administered 3 times at an average age of 18 months, 31 months, and 53 months of age. Data were analyzed using a repeated measures multivariate analysis of variance. The findings suggest that PEDI functional skills scaled scores were capable of measuring change in both groups of children. For children with motor delays, the standard scores on the PEDI functional skills social scale were found to be more sensitive to change than the EMSL receptive and expressive language scores. The authors conclude that using PEDI scaled scores may be an effective strategy for measuring change in children receiving early intervention services. That was a longitudinal study of outcome measures for children receiving early intervention services, by Eagsty et al. And this article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line, this one written by Marcia Levinson of Thomas Jefferson University School of Health Professions and Rosaline Creedon Notho of Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, both in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joining us now is Marcia Levinson. Welcome, Marcia.
Good morning.
First, tell us, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article?
As PTs in early intervention, we must be accountable for our treatment. And this demands that we must use the most appropriate outcome measures to capture measures that are sensitive to change. Early intervention therapists focus on children's function in the natural environment and activities within their daily routines. So valid and reliable tests that measure these activities as well as the participation level are important to consider, especially since we make our treatment focused on these levels and also then formulate goals to measure this progress. So this article demonstrates that the PEDI functional scaled scores are sensitive to change in children who are receiving early intervention with and without motor involvement. The PEDI scaled scores also detect a change early in the first 12 months. In comparing the standard scores, the PEDI social scale was more sensitive than the Mullen expressive and receptive language scales in children with motor delay compared to children without motor delay. The Mullen standard scores were able to detect change in children, though, particularly in expressive language, in those without motor delay, and this is described in Table 6.
And what should a pediatric PT be mindful about when applying this information?
Well, there are many issues that are brought up in this article, and there are competing explanations as to why the PD was more sensitive to change than the Mullen, and this may include the fact that the non-participants were very small and they did not represent the general population of children in early intervention. There wasn't random selection for inclusion in the study. Some of these aspects are explained in Table 1. So there must be caution taken not to generalize these findings beyond this particular sample population. For example, a child with autistic spectrum disorder who may have no motor delay but primary language problems, who was in the early intervention system, may still be better suited to the Mullen than the PD. The difference in sensitivity to changes of these tests also may be explained by other reasons. The fact that there is difference in the content of each domain of these tests. They compared the PD social scale with the Mullen language scales, and although they are similar, they do have different numbers of items and different content in each of the items. The data collection process is different between the tests. In the PD, collection of data is used by getting caregiver report, whereas in the Mullen, there is direct observation. The PD also has more items included in each section and a finer breakdown in the progression of skills towards younger age children with more severe delays than the Mullen, which may point out that it was more sensitive in this area. So the findings of this study do support the use of the PD scaled scores as a sensitive measure of functional change in children receiving early intervention. This study was well done. The primary investigator and assistant were blind to the previous scores. However, there was a huge variation in the sample, and the sample was heterogeneous. We do need to look at sensitive measures, and we do need to promote accountability. There still needs to be further research in other tests that we need to compare and look at sensitivity so that we can promote accountability and provide a guide for formulating goals and for more informed clinical decision making.
Marcia, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Next, the Gross Motor Function Classification System, an update on impact and clinical utility by Laura Gray, Henny Ng, and Doreen Bartlett, all of the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, Canada. The purpose of this study was to examine the impact and utility of the Gross Motor Function Classification System, GMFCS, for children with cerebral palsy in research and clinical settings. The authors performed a scoping review of publications from July 2003 to December 2008. The online literature search was performed to retrieve relevant abstracts for classification according to GMFCS use. The authors report that there has been a steadily increasing use of the GMFCS over the previous decade. Ongoing research was identified on the GMFCS measurement properties, as well as its use in validation of other tools. The primary use of the GMFCS continued to be observational and experimental studies. Some studies discussed the GMFCS in clinical practice with respect to examination and evaluation. The authors conclude that the GMFCS is clearly established as a principal classification system for children with cerebral palsy, as demonstrated by excellent uptake in research. However, literature on its clinical use is emerging more slowly. More emphasis on the clinical utility of the GMFCS in the published literature would be helpful. That was The Gross Motor Function Classification System, an update on impact and clinical utility by Gray, Ng, and Bartlett. This article is the subject of our next clinical bottom line, written by Margaret Barry Michaels of Slippery Rock University in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, and Kelly Basala of both Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and Pine Center Specialty Care Center in Wexford, Pennsylvania. Joining us now is Margaret Barry Michaels. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss the article.
First, tell us, how can a pediatric physical therapist apply the information from this article?
This article utilizes the gross motor function classification system. This system classifies children with cerebral palsy into 5 basic levels. Children classified as level 1 are able to participate in the community with minimal functional limitations, whereas children classified as level 5 have very little movement and often have to be transported in a manual wheelchair. And this scale was first published in 1997, and then an expanded and revised scale was published in 2007. The revised scale extends past the original scale, which went from infancy to 12 years, and goes on to adolescents 12 to 18 years of age as well. There was a review published in 2004 that looked at the initial impact and utility of this scale, and this article looks at the literature from 2003 to 2008. In terms of the methods, the authors used a scoping review of the literature on the gross motor function classification system. A scoping review covers the breadth of the literature. This article has some unique features. Appendix A provides a list of over 200 references, and then Appendix B provides detailed charts, and these charts categorize the articles by use of the classification system, which I think for clinicians is really a benefit. For example, one way they categorized the articles was the utilization of the scale by patient examination, by prognosis, by intervention, and by outcome. So clinicians who are looking to use this classification system will be able to look at the charts and find articles related to a very specific aspect of practice. The article gives very specific examples of important clinical points that are found in the literature. For example, the authors cite studies that found differences in outcomes across the levels of the classification system. So for looking at a specific intervention, they may be better suited to certain levels of functional abilities. So a clinician would be able to utilize the classification system to better identify patients who would benefit from that specific intervention.
And what should a pediatric PT be mindful about when applying this information?
There are a few important points, I think, that need to be kept in mind. The scoping review looks at the breadth of the literature, but does not critique the quality of the literature. And the author suggests that readers can take the articles and do their own critique. However, for some readers, assessing the quality of research articles is a significant challenge. Another important point the authors highlight is the misuse of the classification system in the literature, which demonstrates that even peer-reviewed articles may have errors. Therein lies the benefit of systematic reviews of the literature. So this article highlights the importance of appropriate utilization of the classification system, which is intended for use only in patients with the diagnosis of cerebral palsy. The system is valid for use in infancy through 18 years of age, but not in adults. And the classification system is not an outcome measure. It's not appropriate to use the system to evaluate the effects of an intervention.
Meg, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Next, power mobility and socialization in preschool, a case study of a child with cerebral palsy by Christina Ragonese, Z. Chen, Sunil Agrawal, and James Cole Galloway, all of the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware. Power mobility training for young children and infants appears feasible under controlled conditions. Dynamic, natural environments provide the ultimate test of training. The purposes of this case study were, 1, to determine whether it was feasible for Will, a 3-year-old boy with cerebral palsy, to use a power mobility device, the UD2, in his preschool classroom, and 2, to quantify his classroom mobility and socialization. 2 teachers, 2 typically developing peers, and Will were all filmed daily in class during a baseline phase without the UD2 power mobility device. A mobility phase with the UD2 followed the baseline phase. The authors coded socialization and mobility measures from the video recordings. During the mobility phase with the UD2, Will was more mobile and interactive than during the baseline phase. However, Will remained notably less mobile and less interactive than his peers. The authors conclude that the use and assessment of power mobility in a preschool classroom appear feasible. The authors further discuss issues important to maximizing children's use of power mobility for classroom participation. That was Power Mobility and Socialization in Preschool, a Case Study of a Child with Cerebral Palsy by Ragonese et al. Our last article this month is Pain Assessment and Management in Children with Neurologic Impairment, a Survey of Pediatric Physical Therapists by Mary Swigum, Mary Lynn Hamilton, Peggy Gleason, Tony Roddy, and Katie Mitchell, all of Texas Women's University in Houston, Texas. This study explored pain assessment measures and interventions used by physical therapists in the treatment of children with neurologic impairment. Following an extensive literature review on pain assessment and intervention, the authors developed, pilot-tested, and posted a survey on the listserv of the pediatric section of the American Physical Therapy Association. The authors found that 80% of the respondents used subjective measures to assess pain. 70% used self-report scales. 41% used behavioral and physiological measures. Behaviors frequently used included vocalizations, facial expression, and irritability. Rarely used cues included decreased attention, withdrawal, and changes in sleeping and eating behaviors. Therapists used research-supported pain interventions such as distraction and praise. Therapists also used potentially harmful distress-producing measures, such as procedural talk and reassurance. The authors conclude that further research is needed to determine the feasibility of using behavioral pain assessment measures during physical therapy sessions. Physical therapist continuing education regarding non-pharmaceutical pain interventions is indicated. That was Pain Assessment and Management in Children with Neurologic Impairment, a Survey of Pediatric Physical Therapists, by Swigum et al. This article is the subject of our last clinical bottom line, this written by Bart Bartels and Paul Helders, both of University Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Utrecht, the Netherlands. Addressing the topic of how a pediatric physical therapist can apply the information from this article, the authors write, "Pain, and in particular, acute pain, in children has gained much attention during the last decennia. Currently, post-surgical pain and painful procedures are managed very differently. Pain management in children is a much tailored procedure. It not only requires careful consideration of the child's age and cognitive, communicative, physical, and psychological abilities, but it also requires observation of the child's behavioral expressions, such as facial grimacing, sweating, withdrawals, and movements. Most current literature deals with acute pain. Little is known about pain that occurs during rehabilitative procedures. Reports indicate that one of the most salient negative memories of childhood in adults with neurologic impairment was pain related to stretching and bracing by physical therapists." The authors of this article performed a survey among practicing pediatric physical therapists to explore, 1, the use of pain assessment tools, and 2, the intervention strategies used to reduce pain during treatment of children with neurologic impairment. They found that more than 80% of the therapists reported using subjective measures to assess pain in this population. About 45% of the respondents used behavioral measures, whereas 40% used heart rate, oxygen saturation, and blood pressure as a physiological measure to assess pain. Next to these standardized measures, therapists also reported watching for irritability, crying, vocalizations, and facial grimacing. The most often used pain management strategies were distraction, procedural talk, and praise. For inpatients, referral to a child life specialist was suggested. The authors conclude that it appears that physical therapists rely on subjective observations to assess pain in children with neurologic impairments, despite the availability of standardized behavioral assessments. The authors further conclude that a lack of awareness could explain this phenomenon. As an alternative explanation, they suggest that current behavioral tools are not conducive for use during real-time physical therapy sessions. Addressing the question of what a pediatric PT should be mindful about when applying this information, Bart Bartels and Paul Helders reply, "The authors of this article brought a relevant and clinically important problem to our attention. Too little is known about painful procedures in pediatric physical therapy practice. Many questions still need to be answered. What are painful procedures? Are those evidence-based? And if not, can they be avoided? Also, when does the pain occur? During or after the procedure? And when does the pain wear off? Can procedures be changed so that they do not hurt? Is a pharmacological co-intervention possible? Finally, is hypnosis possible for these interventions?" The study in question just touches a part of the problem. It is a first step in unraveling this question of pain in pediatric physical therapy. Unfortunately, the study is underpowered because of a very low response rate. More important, it is unclear whether the authors studied just children with cerebral palsy or children with a neurologic impairment, and how this term was operationalized. Equally important to know is the way children were able to express themselves, as well as their underlying medical disorder. With this information, the authors could have analyzed pain behavior in subgroups of children. The merit, though, of this study is that it has brought an important and clinically relevant topic to our attention. Moreover, it clearly shows us that more studies are needed to be able to fully assess and manage pain due to painful procedures in pediatric physical therapy practice. Thanks for listening. This podcast is a production of Science Audio, online at www.scienceaudio.net. Please send us your comments or questions to PEDPT, that's PEDPT, at scienceaudio.net. Get the full text of all pediatric physical therapy articles online at www.pedpt.com.